I see some new faces, and I'm trying to figure out how to tie some things together that we've been talking about during these days. I wonder if I could see who are the new people here today. Oh, boy. Well, that's interesting. I kind of anticipated that, so I put back on the board, if you were in Bible study, it was off, and I put it back on what we were doing yesterday, and we ended about a minute and a half before the end of time, I would like to give you a chance to rebut in any way you'd like and to relate to this. Let me see if I can do in 4 minutes or so for the half the audience today who was not here yesterday. What I've tried to say is that as I have been working in the health field, I started as a parish pastor and was in a parish for 5 years. Then I became a hospital chaplain and was that for 8 years, and then moved to the University of Chicago, to the medical school for 12 years, and then to Baylor Medical School, the Department of Psychiatry for 3 years. I hated Houston because it was so hot and humid. And moved to Wittenberg University as professor of practical theology. That meant that the other guys were all professors of impractical theology. That's just a joke. Then from there, I was there for 5 years, and then now I've been at the University of Illinois, which is in Chicago, the medical school, for the last 12 years. I retired 2 years ago and then have gone back to work. I couldn't stand it. What I found as I began as a chaplain in the hospital was that very soon on, I began noticing that patients were telling me about something in their lives which they had lost. They had lost a job, or they had lost a promotion, or they had lost all their friends because they had to be transferred to another community. And I saw so many people who were there in relation to loss that I began to feel that about 1 out of every 3 patients in any general hospital is there because he's grieving. So I became interested in the grief process, began to develop that, and I will get to that today I will put together yet tomorrow's lecture and today's lecture into one toward the end and all tomorrow. So you'll get to grief, don't worry about that. What really fascinated me about grief was that more people were in grief than I ever dreamed were in grief. And one Sunday, when I was preaching at Rockefeller Chapel, and it went out over WGN radio, I decided to preach on grief because I was so aware of it. On a typical Sunday, I would get, a dozen to 3 dozen letters from people wanting copies of the sermon. On the Sunday that I preached on grief, we got over 1,000 letters. So I figured that I was dealing with a very important thing, but I also felt that I was getting to be a pretty good preacher. So the next time I was invited to preach, I worked doubly hard on my sermon, preached it in a couple Lutheran churches first, and then finally got to the great Rockefeller Chapel and preached this sermon, and then sat back and waited for the avalanche of mail. I got 12 letters. And that put me in my place. But I began to realize that the whole field of grief was universal, and that everybody experiences grief of one type or another, and that grief is not limited just to the death of a loved one, but that it has to do with every aspect of one's life, and we'll get to that in a bit today. Then I became aware of stress through the works of Hans Selye, and now everybody's talking about the stress of life and how it causes illnesses. And then life changes, having to do with any change that occurs in your life, such a simple thing as moving from one house to another, or moving from one town to another. And this was based on Thomas Holmes' work with 43 different kinds of changes in one's life, and he gave numerical value to each one. And when you add it up, you came out with a certain number. If you came out with around 100, that was about average. Everybody should have 100. If you had 200 points, that meant that your chances of getting sick, because this was upsetting the equilibrium of your body would increase by 1 out of 3 people would get that, would have some kind of illness as a result of it. Maybe they didn't have to go to the doctor, but they were under the weather. If you had 300 points, your chances of getting sick were 1 in 2, statistically. And if you had 400 points, your chances of getting sick were 80%. And that was pretty well established and has held up well. It's about 10 years old now. So, I do feel that we all have to know that stress is a part of our existence. One night I had a group of people that I talked with, and I gave them this test, which takes only about 5 minutes, and got the answers back and the numbers. And everybody was a little bit under 100. It was strange, but it was the dullest group I've ever been with. Which I think says something about the importance of stress. But it's kind of like a violin string. And when you put the string on and then you tighten it up and you don't have it very tight and you have the bow go across, you don't get any sound to speak of, at least it's not worth hearing. And then you tighten it up a little tighter, and if you tighten it too much, it might snap. And so you go back a little bit to get it just right, and then you get the right tone. And I think that's what we're all striving to do, to decide, to figure out for ourselves what our stress quotient should be. Some of us need more stress in our lives than others. Some of us need less stress. But to say, I want to get rid of stress is absolutely impossible, and you wouldn't want that at all, because you wouldn't want a violin that had no stress at all, no tension. So this is a part of life, and stress can be wonderful. But then I began to realize that one's outlook on life was really the most important thing, and that all these other things would fall into line in relationship to how one looked at life. And this is the thing that the church has been concerned with forever, and with which a minister has constantly to be concerned with, how he is helping his people and himself to look at life. And then I realized that that is really something that ought to be included in medical education. And so that's what I've been pushing very hard through these 40 years. Then I began to look at the American medical system and healthcare system, and found myself describing it with this wedge going this way, and realizing that at least 50% of the people who come to a doctor's office are there because of some relationship to loss, grief, stress, life changes, or outlook on life. At least 50%. But doctors are now telling me that it's closer to 80%, 90%, even 100% of their patients. When a doctor is very sensitive, he'll say that, I'd say 100% of my patients have this basically involved in their illness. As to which came first, I'm not sure. So we see illness then as the body's way of trying to express something. It's like a drama, and it's a drama in 3 acts. And I tried to say this is act 1, these are the little bit sick people, act 2, the medium sick people, and act 3, the really sick people. And then we describe the fact that in act 1, we have no doctors to speak of, less than 1%. Because this is people helping people, and this is what I want to get into today and get your reactions as to why you think, if you think so or not, that the church, and I put here the parish church, ought to be involved in Act 1 more than it now sees itself to be. Act 2 is where the family doctor comes into the picture and the community hospital. And about 29%, they say, of physicians are in family medicine, of some kind of primary care. Then we come to Act 3, which is just a little bit, only 10% of sick people on any given day are in Act 3. But some 70% of doctors have gone into the narrow specialties. And that's how our system is set up at the present time. But there is real concern about this. And when you look here and ask where is the medical school, it's way over here. And this is where we teach young people to become doctors, and they're taught only by super specialists in teaching and research hospitals, which have these remarkable research projects going on. But teaching and research hospitals only constitute 0.1% of the problems of sickness on any given day. So the medical student has his whole understanding of healthcare skewed to the really, really sick and the super, super specialist. And that's the kind he wants to be, and that's why 70% have gone into super specialties. Now, there has been, over the past roughly 7 years, a reaction against this by leaders of medical education, and they're saying, we must stop teaching medical students their clinical work, that is, bedside work, in the teaching and research hospital, because then they all want to become super specialists. Let's put them out here into the community hospitals where they'll meet the primary care physicians who know their patients, who've related to their patients for years, where there's love and trust and respect between them. Let them see that this is really the most exciting kind of healthcare, because here you can do something about it and you can reverse the process. I've shown here the reversing, getting back to wellness, which is over here. And we are now seeing a movement toward a different percentage, so that we see that the ideal would be we only need 30% of doctors to take care of the very, very sick. We need to move this one up from 29% to 65% at least. These are general percentages. We need to put 4% in the Act 4, which we've added, having to do with chronic illnesses, geriatrics, hospice care, dying patients, death, and the relatives of dying patients. This doesn't change Act 1 the least bit, I'm sorry to say. I can't get doctors interested in Act 1 because a person doesn't go through 4 years of medical school and 3 or 4 years of residency to take care of runny noses. And he really, she wants to work with sick, sick people. And I'm saying, let's get off the doctor's back and quit saying what they ought to do. Let them do what they want to do and what they do so well. And let's decide how we, lay people generally, are going to take care of Act 1. As I look at Act 1, I see four groups of people that are already involved in it to some extent, and I hope to a greater extent. First of all, nurses. Nurses have long been interested in patient education and have gone way out of their way to teach, for instance, heart patients how not to have to come back again with another heart attack or another stroke. And nurses have done this against great resistance. I have to admit, great resistance of the medical team. The doctor has said, I'll do the teaching, but he never quite gets around to doing it. So the nurses have had to kind of do this on the sly. And now it's generally accepted, but it's taken 20 years for nurses to get this to be generally accepted in most every hospital. Though I was in a hospital recently where the nurses told me they still were not allowed to teach patients. Second group are people in the social sciences, social workers, psychologists, health educators, and I put particularly here school teachers. We took a whole group of school teachers, of all the teachers in a certain school district around one of our holistic health centers, because one of our patients was the superintendent of that district, and he felt that his experience of being treated by a doctor, a nurse, and a pastor together in a church basement where his offices were, along with the pastor and the nurse, was an unusual experience for him, and he wanted the rest of his teachers to experience this. So we did a series of workshops for about 300-400 teachers. The response was very interesting, because what we tried to get across to the teacher was that she, mostly she, deals with people, with children in the early stages of illness, where you can really begin to see those early reactions to stress, loss, grief, and so on, starting with the loss of a pet, for instance. Certainly the loss of a grandmother or a grandfather. And these teachers now are telling us that they, in their understanding of the causes of illness, they think they are a little more helpful to the parents than they would have been if they hadn't had this kind of training. The third group are clergy. And for 40 years, clergy have been attending three-month workshops in general hospitals, mental hospitals, social agencies, penal institutions. But we haven't quite learned how to integrate their new information with their own ministries. And that's what we're trying now to have happen. But about 100,000 clergy have spent at least 3 months in this kind of training, walking alongside doctors and nurses in their locations. And finally, the group that I'm most excited about are the lay people who have been a part of each of our holistic centers. We have some a dozen of these centers around the country. We have six of them in the Chicago area. We started the first one in Springfield, Ohio, where when I was teaching there in practical theology, I had said in an article that I had written that I thought that seminary students ought to spend part of their time outside the seminary classroom so they'd find out what was going on in the neighborhood. So they asked me to come there and either put up or shut up. And so I tried then to become an assistant pastor in a local church in the lowest income neighborhood of Springfield. And with my students, we sat down with the principal of the local public school, the assistant principal, the school nurse, and the school social worker. And it was the school nurse who said, "Do you realize that this is the sickest neighborhood in all of Springfield? There are no doctors in our community, and the people are really in bad shape. We ought to do something about it." So it was in that church, Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, that we got other churches in the neighborhood, St. Joe's Roman Catholic Church, Trinity African Methodist Church, Clifton Avenue United Methodist Church, Christ Episcopal Church, and we got groups of lay people from all these churches, and we put them together as helpers, and then we got volunteer doctors, volunteer nurses, and my students who were volunteer pastors, as it were, and we had a ball, because we found ourselves working together in a holistic fashion that was not true before. I was then invited to Howard Medical School in Washington, D.C., a black school, and they said, "We like your idea of putting these people together and doing the dealing with the patient not only physically and mentally, but also spiritually. But are you only going to do this in poor neighborhoods?" And I said, "Yes, why?" "Well, because you're not going to really excite the medical profession as long as it's in poor neighborhoods, because they're going to say, well, sure, these people will be glad to come into such a clinic because it's free. But if this were in a middle-income neighborhood and you were competing against other doctors, this wouldn't work," they'd say. "We think you ought to test this out in middle-income neighborhoods and even upper-income neighborhoods and see if you can show that if you put a doctor's office in a church and you add a nurse who is competent in patient education and nutrition, and you add a pastor who has had specialized training in psychosomatic medicine and clinical psychology along with his theology, and you put those three together, if you can prove that that'll make a difference, then you will have proven that it works because people are willing to pay for it." And when I came back from Washington, D.C., I was on cloud nine, and we finally decided that that's what we would do, and we ended up at the University of Illinois Medical School in the Department of Preventive Medicine, asking the head of the department, who was Jewish, if he'd be willing to work out such a pattern. And he was excited by it and has been for 12 years, worked right with us on every aspect of the work. So we decided to start in one of the richest neighborhoods in Chicago, where they have more doctors per square foot than in any other neighborhood of Chicago, Hinsdale. I went to the Lutheran church first and offered and said, "We'd like to do it in our church." And they said, "Well, no, we're not quite ready for that." I went to the Congregational church and they said, "Hey, this is great." So I've had my office in a Congregational church for 12 years. And it's made me sad to think I couldn't do it in my own church. But as the minister said, we just don't want to rock the boat with any new ideas. Oh, he was getting near the end of his ministry. He's a dear friend of mine. So we did that. And we had a dickens of a time getting anybody to come. Because as one lady said to me after church one Sunday, "I don't know why we have a clinic in our church. There are no poor people in Hinsdale." And I said, it isn't for poor people, it's for rich people like you. And she said, of course, oh, I'm not rich. And she got into her long Mercedes Benz. But eventually the millionaires and others began coming in, and that clinic is still going after roughly 11 years now. We then decided we had to go into a middle-income neighborhood. We went to a Methodist church, and that one took off right now because it was a new neighborhood. Then we went to a rural church, and a Lutheran church, and we had great difficulty getting that one going because rural people, they don't want to talk about their illnesses. I got a pain doc, fix me up, don't ask me any questions. But we got a rural doctor and a rural pastor and a rural nurse, and that took off finally. Then we were ready to go back into the inner city, and we started a church, a center in a former Catholic convent. And this was truly holistic because in the basement we had a workshop teaching people how to repair their homes, electrically, carpentry work, and so on. First floor was the clinic with three doctors who had thought of going to foreign fields but whose spouses would rather stay in America, and besides, this looked like a foreign field where they were. And so they are there yet, some, I think, 7 years ago. And the next floor up, we had the social workers who were dealing with the social problems of that community. And on the top floor, we had two young lawyers who dealt with the many legal problems that these people had. So there you have a kind of a more holistic clinic. And that one has been a very interesting clinic. Next, we were ready for an elderly area, for a geriatric kind, and we chose Oak Park in a large Presbyterian church there. But soon we found that they wanted to bring their young people in too, so now it's a general clinic. We have six clinics in the Chicago area, and then two in Washington, D.C., one in Baltimore, one in Philadelphia, the Episcopal Church there, one in Minneapolis, in Trinity Lutheran Church in the Minnehaha area, one in Tucson, Arizona, and a couple in Sioux City, Iowa, and so on. That's been the result of what we have seen here. But we now feel that a dozen clinics are demonstration projects, and that's about what they are. Because it's very expensive to start these clinics, and I have been beholden to the W.K. Kellogg Foundation for many of the startup funds. I've been eating cornflakes like mad ever since. But they really are a wonderful group of people, dedicated Christian people in Michigan. So now we've come up with the idea, what if we just put a nurse on the staff of a church? Would that make a difference? And so we've been testing this out in an LCA church in Tucson, Arizona, and right across the street from the medical school. And the idea there is to put a nurse on the staff, not to be a sickness nurse, but to be a wellness nurse, to encourage people to take care of themselves while they're still well, and to know that this is where you can stay much of the time, and that many people, what percentage? At least a third of people, but I really think it's closer to 50% of people would not have to go into this area if they took care of themselves better back here. And that's preventive medicine. There's no money in it. There are very few people in it. It's the dullest course in medical school curriculum. The students don't like it. It has a lot of statistics in it, a lot of epidemiology. Many of the students don't even bother to come to class. So I don't hold much hope for preventive medicine in medical schools. But I am convinced that that is what the church has been about for all its centuries. It has been in the healthcare field, but does not know it. And now I think we ought to go into it more intentionally and see where we can develop this program, and it's people like you folks gathered in this room who are going to make it happen. And I'm determined to keep telling this story wherever I go, over and over again, until you're not satisfied, until the staff of your church has a nurse on it, who would be called whatever they decide to call themselves, a minister of health. We have ministers of Christian education. We have ministers of music. Why not a minister of health? Do you realize that whenever we started a mission field, wanted to start a church in Africa or China or India or someplace, who did we send? usually three people, a pastor, the missionary, a nurse, a missionary nurse, and a missionary doctor. But we never seem to think that that's important to do in America. I would like to see us start a new mission station, a new church, and say that we would right away call a pastor and a nurse. And I think the community would be quite surprised. But I think that if the nurse were seen not as a sickness person, but as a wellness person, this would be understandable. And in the church in Tucson, we're finding that the people there are using her for four things. First, she's a health educator, and she's teaching. Seminars, workshops, discussion groups, potluck supper groups, all kinds of things. She has now reached, out of the 1,500 members of that church, some 400 people who have taken courses that she's had. Secondly, she's a personal health counselor, and the line is forming to the right, and all kinds of people are coming to her with problems of the type that they didn't ever have enough courage to talk to their pastor about or their doctor about, which I think is very interesting. Thirdly, she is developing a cadre of people within that congregation who are just naturally helpful people to other people. And she's training them how to do it better, training them with listening skills, training them with medical understandings, with some diagnostic skills, the ability to refer them to her or to somebody else in the community. And the fourth thing she does is to help people who are in early stages of problems of one kind or another to get to support groups. Almost every community in America has access to support groups, such as Alcoholics Anonymous, which we all understand. But you can make a list of 50 other support groups for all kinds of problems where people will help each other. And that's where the church has particular ability to get people together to help one another. Now, let me stop there. And that was 4 minutes. And see where we go with this. What are some of your reflections on this now? Yes?
I was in a multiple staff church, and it's not along this line at all, but there was a retired man who had a full career in business consultation and so forth, and was looking for a place originally just to office in exchange for volunteer work, and eventually evolved into a very effective senior citizens ministry. He began basically putting together programs and so on for them, but eventually ended up doing a lot of consulting, helping them to stay in their own homes as long as possible, helping arrange private nursing care. He became sort of a social worker, educator, pastor, everything all rolled into one, and he started it. I think he was 65 or 68, and he's still going strong 5 or 8 years later.
This is what I think can happen. Lay people can do all kinds of things that they never thought they could do. And with so many lay people retiring now at 60, we've got potential like we've never had before. Okay, yes?
It's been fascinating to me in the last few months. I've been doing my own personal study, going through the Word and looking up areas to see what God has to say about dealing with areas of stress in our life. And I just got a huge card to file of it. Come up with because it's just so obvious that God does not intend for us to have to struggle with these kinds of things like anxiety, depression, grief, this type of thing. He has the answer for it. That will keep him in perfect peace. His mind is stayed on you. I mean, there's just so much, just the Psalms and all through the Word. And it's just, I think if the lay people could get this information, I think if we, you know, people were more aware of what God does have to offer and they were willing to share this with our fellow men, this would go a long way in this area.
You bet. The Stevens series does a lot of this. How many are aware of the Stevens series? Good, but not enough yet. The Stevens series, started by a pastor in St. Louis, Missouri Synod, has now been reaching thousands of people who come and spend, what is it, a week or 2 weeks for a specialized course, usually the pastor and some other person in the church. And then they go back to their home parish and they teach the same course that they received in the Stevens series. There are all kinds of Catholic nuns doing this with the priest of the parish and then coming out into Catholic churches. And he never expected Catholics to follow in this at all. But he now does this in, I think, 5 different settings around America each year. Just be aware of it if you can find out more about the Stevens series. It is excellent, and it's a teaching that these people then become very competent in ministering to one another, just as you said, based on scripture. There's another hand, yes.
Well, what I've been thinking about, and I'm sure most of you who were here at the Bible study are thinking of the same thing, is how much this is related to what we were just talking about in terms of those Bible passages that Dan was talking to us about. He was talking about how the faith that we have is not simply to deal with what happens to us when we die, whether we go to heaven or hell, but the wholeness of our life throughout our lives, and how the physical earth and all the creatures are being redeemed. And here you are talking about wholeness in terms of our entire body, not just our minds or our souls, but the whole person.
Where can we make contact with the Stevens series?
I wish I could just tell you right offhand how to do that.
Can we post it someplace? I can find the address, I'm sure.
All right. Fred will post it someplace and probably on the bulletin board.
Okay.
Fine, because that's important.
Fred, give it to me and I'll make sure it gets out.
Fine. Yes?
Is there any effort to get professional counselors operate out of churches?
Yes, we've been working at that for the last 30 years. And we've got, I'll bet we have, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 churches which now have professional counselors in them. And that's fine. And in some of those churches, we will put the nurse in addition, so we'll have those too. And maybe 3 to 5 years down the line, we'll be able to add a doctor to that.
My daughter was going to a professional counselor in Stockton, California, and I asked her if the counselor ever made reference to religion or God or faith. And she said, no. And I said, I don't think you're really going to get the help you're looking for until you go to some church that has this sort of ministry. And she finally joined a Lutheran church in Lodi, California, with 3 ministers on the staff. She said the difference between what kind of counseling she's getting as against a professional counselor in Stockton is the difference between night and day.
That's right. That's right. One group is called the Samaritan Group, and they are in about 75 churches now around America, and they have pastoral counselors who are especially trained. There's a group called the American Association of Pastoral Counselors, very high standards, and they're requiring every pastor who gets into it to have had all kinds of very good training. So, yes, that's coming. We haven't tried the nurse yet, except in Tucson. And I'm now working with Lutheran General Hospital in Chicago area, Park Ridge. And we're planning to have 6 nurses from 6 churches. And Lutheran General is sponsoring this idea. These 6 nurses will meet with us once a week for a half a day to discuss the journals which they'll be keeping. They'll write in their journal every day at the church the experiences they're having. They'll then bring their journals and share them with us all. We will put this down on paper and then gradually put together a curriculum for these nurses, which will then, we hope, over a period of 3 years, develop a new specialty within nursing called, whatever they choose to call it, nurses in churches or parish church nurse or whatever. And in that way, we will have a textbook put together in 3 years, which we can share with you around the country to do this out of some hospital that you know and to get a number of churches together. These 6 churches will be a Roman Catholic Church, a Presbyterian, a Methodist, a Congregationalist, and a Lutheran Church, and two Lutheran churches. Got to give the Lutherans a little break here. Now, do you think this would work? Oh, go ahead.
Well, in relationship to your question,
question, my question would deal with the problem with the economic support, which would be among one of the first obstacles prior to the local congregation. And if we could somehow make a diagram of economics, an overlay over what you did here, that would enable congregations to see a portion of legacies that would be given to the church would not be just for building monuments and tacking up new whatever, but realizing that the biggest part of the church are the people, and to reinvest or to reappropriate funds for purposes of working with that.
That's right. We're starting on a half-time basis simply because of the financial problem. Half a nurse's salary in the Chicago area would be $11,000. So the church finds $11,000 somehow with the help of, usually outside the budget, the first year. The second year, well, already in Tucson, the nurse is finding that people want to give some donation after they've spent a half an hour, an hour with her, and so they leave $5 to $10. And see, she's been bringing in roughly, I think, $75 a week or something like that. Maybe a little more than that now, the last I heard. So it will be partially self-sustaining, but we don't think it should be fully, because we think everybody should feel free to come, whether they have money or not. There's another hand over here.
That was my question. I was wondering how they are financed.
That's right.
What would be your recommendation for very small churches?
I don't know yet. We're starting with the larger churches simply because it's the only way we know to get going. Mm-hmm. We think we would go to two churches having one nurse before long, so that they would go back and forth. But we don't want to do this at start because we think it's important for the nurse to be very visible on Sunday mornings. The nurse is seen reading scripture, for instance, on a regular basis. She is there for 4 to 5 hours from the time the first service begins to an hour after the last service, and is available to people who want to stop by. She's available for doing blood pressure testing. She brings other nurses into this, and she finds other people to help her. But at first, we think it's good for her to be available on Sunday and to be known by everybody. We think she should not wear a white outfit with a white hat and look too sick-like. But when I go back, when I think back on where this idea gradually germinated, I remember preaching in a black church in Springfield years ago, where as the service was beginning, some 10 or 15 women, all dressed like nurses, came and sat up in the front row. And I thought, my land, is this a graduation exercise or something? Not at all. The services go on, they tell me, for 2 to 3 hours in this church, and people faint every now and then, and they need these people to catch them and to be available around and to pick up children who are making too much noise and carry them out. And these women do this every Sunday. So the black churches have done this. Yes?
When we have funerals in our church for some black member who has died, there will always be the nurses around.
Is that so?
Because it becomes very emotional at times, and people have fainted.
So in a way, I think I got the general idea from that experience, but I don't want it to be seen as a nurse to take care of people who are going to faint, necessarily. She can do that if that happens. I want to put health care in the context of health. As I said to the group on Monday, if a pollster were to come to your neighborhood and knock on the door and ask, what are the health agencies of this community? The average person would answer with the name of a local hospital or two and maybe some well-known medical clinics. Technically, those are not health agencies. Those are sickness agencies. They take care of us after we get sick. So what are the health agencies? I see the home, the school, the church, the workplace, and the public health department really involved in keeping us healthy. And if they're not doing their job well, we get sick. And if they're doing their job very well, we have a healthy community. And I think we have to keep that in mind. I have a hand right in back of yours first, and then yours. Yes, Barbara?
Well, I don't really know if I should talk or not, because
I suppose there is like some really basic theological questions are coming up for me at the same time that I'm real excited about all of the things we're talking about. I guess one of it is because I've had a real, I don't belong to church, and although I have a very strong spirituality and belief in God, and my church is where I am at any given moment, to me that is what church is. And living that out is a real challenge. But part of the reason for all of this is that here's this whole holistic movement and so much of my struggle, and I understand the need for organization, but as church has come about since civilization, there has been so much separatism and fragmentation promoted through it that it is in an opposite direction from a holistic point of view in a lot of instances I've run up against. Like by the very fact that you have to have the Lutherans over here, and you have to have a name and a label, and then there's different synods, and then Catholics over here. I guess I'm just wondering, how can all churches start to drop what is in our way from seeing that we really are all one? And I'm concerned about that, and not only the church, but there are many other organizations that maybe aren't churches who are pioneering the same kind of things, which goes back to something much simpler, and it was something that, you know, if you got down Christ's message from 2,000 years ago to an essence of maybe 10 words, it's love your neighbor. And who is your neighbor? And to me, that is whoever is there for everybody at a given point in time, period. And so it's a tough one because there is a need for structure and a need for organization, but I guess I'm trying to see how can churches not only expand into this realm, but also open their doors up to be inclusive of a wholeness to all people.
One of the things that is related to what you're saying in the fact that the church has tended to deal only with its own people, mm-hmm. is that one of the questions that was asked us when we started a holistic health center in a church, well, you know, many of these people have their own doctor. They're not going to come to this clinic. You don't have enough people in this church to keep a clinic going. For a doctor's office to be kept going, she needs 2,000 patients who feel that they look to this doctor as their doctor. So what has happened? Our patient load in each of our clinics runs around 2,000 to 3,000 patients. One third of these patients are active church members someplace. Only 10% of the patients that we have who are active belong to the local church in which we have the center. So that means already we're moving outside that church into other denominations. The second third of patients may belong to some church, but they seldom go, Christmas and Easter. Now that brings us into a wider group of people who are coming into the clinics. The third group, according to the research that's been done by a non-religious group, the third group have no church connection whatsoever. And when they were asked, as they were, some 500 of them, in quizzed by this research team, why would you go to a center in a church when you don't even belong to any church? And some of you put down the word agnostic, and some of you even atheist. And the general answer was that in the healthcare field, there are no denominations, and that we couldn't care less about that. We heard that they are concerned about people as human beings. We heard that the doctors, the nurse, and the minister there were open to an understanding of the spiritual dimension of life. And just because we're agnostics or atheists doesn't mean we don't believe in the spiritual dimension of life. And they were most eager to talk on the telephone more than a half an hour with the people that called them. And so our research shows that what you're saying, we at least are beginning to deal with, that this kind of effort, dealing with healthcare, immediately breaks down the barriers of denominations. Breaks down the barriers of interreligion, so that now we have people of varying Buddhists and other religions coming to our clinics. And you say, well, but are you really giving the message of Jesus Christ to these people? We're not clobbering them with it, I can assure you of that. But we are there in the name and in the spirit of Christ, and we at no time hesitate if they ask us to talk about the meaning of our faith. But one third are active church members, the second third are general just belong to church, and a third third have no connection with church whatsoever. That's a cross-section of America. That's exactly what the American scene looks like. So I feel good about the fact that when I'm in healthcare, I'm really much more ecumenical than I am when I'm just coming in as a pastor talking about my church and I would like them to join it. Yes?
I really like this discussion, so I'm afraid to, I don't want really backtrack very much. I was interested in your comment on the taking the nurse's salary and then working with that. And I think that this opportunity of having nurses operating in churches would give us a new opportunity to really look closely at the value of health care and evaluate it differently than it's evaluated in society, which is quite low on the pay scale, and put it into a realm where we really value those people enough to pay them and put that into a little better realm of justice. Secondly,
are you a nurse?
No.
Oh, okay.
Secondly, I'm interested in your reference to Chicago General because I was, or Lutheran General in Chicago, because I was going to ask how much support, what kind of attitude you have received from the church-affiliated medical world, which is a pretty structured, bureaucratic one. And I don't know how they'd respond to something so innovative.
Lutheran General?
Or other Lutheran.
Well,
Lutheran.
I have to say, the Lutheran General Hospital, in my book, is the one hospital in the world that is trying harder than any other Christian hospital, church-related hospital, to bring together the Christian spirit and medical science.
What about elsewhere?
What?
What about elsewhere?
Elsewhere, I can say that there are 1,000 hospitals that I know of in America that are working hard at it. But there are 11,000 hospitals in America, so we still have a few to go.
Because I know the Lutheran General is really progressive this way.
That's right.
In Chicago,
now,
but there
when you
are
speak,
others,
when
church-related ones that I think are less progressive.
That's right. When you think when you mention the salary, what we did was to put the salary at the same salary of the average of pastors in America.
Hmm.
22,000 is where we are in the Lutheran Church of America. So we pay the nurse the same salary that we pay pastors. You had a question.
Well, I was just, I got sidetracked from my original comment. Going way back to this idea of wellness and, illness versus wellness. When you were talking, I was reminded of a neighboring pastor, AMC pastor, who recently died from cancer. Extremely long, well, it was Hodgkin's disease. He had an extremely long and difficult death. And as he was in the hospital, the family and some friends were gathered around him, and he was seemingly comatose. And then he opened his eyes, and one of the family says, "Oh, he's still among the land of the living." And looked at them and says, "No, I'm still among the land of the dying." And that was this idea, it just struck me as being appropriate. But coming back to this comment of this lady back here, I view myself and I view from the point of view of Scripture that I'm called into community. I'm called not as an individual Christian, me and God against the world, but rather I'm called into the community of the fellowship, of faith, the body of Christ. And I can deal with this faith, the full-blown faith, the wheel of concept of faith, but that faith has to hit the road, and it is through the church and through the organized church that I have the this is the instrument through which I live my faith. I like this idea, and I think it ties in so beautifully with our Bible study this morning, that we are called to be a part of the plan that God has created for all creation and all people and all things, to be ministers. Be a part of their pain as well as their joy.
the other comments. I'd just like to make a couple comments at the very end here now, relating to the grief cycle, because I guess I find myself saying that I got more and more interested in health care because of what I was learning about the grief process. And that the grief process is so tied up with this business of one's outlook on life that for the sicknesses in our civilization to be dealt with almost entirely by scientific types who have not been in any way related to spiritual dimensions of illness, philosophical dimensions of illness. And as I have worked in medical schools now for 23 years, I just can't believe how they can spend 4 years in that school and never hear the word God mentioned except God damn something. That it just never comes up. And what's thrilling to me is that a large percentage of medical schools now have within the last 10 years added ministers to their staff because they feel something is lacking. But that doesn't mean that we have gotten this into the warp and woof of the whole structure of the curriculum that they have. It just goes on as if God didn't exist. And the awful thing is that it goes back in history to one of our own people who, and let me just tell you the story because I think it should, it has helped me to understand this. A long time ago, a little boy grew up in Sweden whose name was Ajax Carlson. And he was a very sensitive little boy who, when he walked on, I heard all this from his lips, so I know it's true. He walked barefooted and he would feel the different kinds of earth under him and the different kinds of stone and rock. And anyway, at the age of 18, he came over to this country and he was going to be a minister. And he went to Augustana College in Rock Island. But he was a very inquisitive type boy and he asked all kinds of questions. And he bothered the professors there, particularly in the religion department of the college. But he was still going to be a minister, so he went off one summer and did some preaching in a little rural church. And they sent a letter saying that this man was saying things that should never be said from a pulpit. And so when he got back to school, they told him he must never say things like that. He must always just stay right with the established party line. And he didn't like that. And then he got into school, more classes, and they kicked him out of class. And then he had to go to the president, Dr. Andrain, and Andrain shook his finger at him and said, "Now you just have, we know you have ideas, but you shouldn't ask questions like that." And he was not supposed to. He finally then broke away from the church at about the age, I'm not sure, 23, and went into medicine and physiology and became the outstanding physiologist of America and wrote the book called The Machinery of the Body. The Machinery of the Body. And he contributed more. Every medical school in America practically used this book as their basic text. The body was a machine. The person was a machine. The spiritual was not mentioned. And when I came to the University of Chicago, he had already retired. He was 78 or by that time. And I asked for a chance to talk to him because he still had an office there as an emeritus professor. And I had heard from students that he laughed at religion and that he would, when he showed them a cadaver for the first time, he'd say, "Would you, anybody here want to come down and help me find the soul? Ha ha ha." And that was the stance that was taken in medical education for half a century. And I said to him, "Why did you do that? Why did you do that to people? Because you're such a likable guy. Everybody loves you. And yet you really turned everybody off on religion." And then he told me this story. And then he told me this story. That's what we've done to some of the great minds in America, because our minds were so narrow that we could not see the whole picture, and we would not allow for questions to be asked. And I think it's pretty tragic. But tomorrow I'm going to talk about how we move gradually in what I think of as growth, if I can get this to work, growth toward maturity. Because I happen to think that what I see among people who are going through great grief, certain people have found the key to making grief something that is one of the most meaningful things they've ever gone through, and they come out of it at a much higher level of understanding than they went into it. They come out of it as stronger people, as deeper people, as people much better able to help other people. Mm-hmm. And I just kept saying that so much at home, I see good coming out of grief. But that was when my wife said, oh, good grief. So that's how we got started with the title of the book. And if any of you want to read it, they have only 10 copies over there, the bookstore. But it's just a little tiny paperback. You can read it in an hour. Share it with somebody. I really would appreciate it if some of you could read it in advance for tomorrow, and then we'll work on it tomorrow. Yes?
Did Charlie Brown steal
the book? Yeah, Charlie Brown. I haven't checked with him yet, but I will. Thank you very much.